Hi everyone, welcome to the Idiots Podcast, that's infectious disease insight of two specialists. I'm James, that's Callum, and we're going to tell you everything you need to know about infectious disease.
Soon may the editing come to discontinue the Tazo Sun. One day when the CRP's done, we'll take our leave and go.
Callum, I have to take issue with something that you said a little while ago. We were talking about, you know, Tenacious D's debut album, and you were telling me that Tribute you didn't think was very good. You can't diss Tribute, son. Speaking of which, aren't we going to talk about distribution today, Callum?
We're going to distribute some knowledge on distribution.
Oh, that's good. So, yeah, we're going through our pharmacokinetics of antibiotics and sort of how that affects how we choose an antimicrobial. And so this, we've already done one on absorption and bioavailability. This one is on distribution. So, where does the antibiotic go when it gets absorbed?
So, yeah, so this is where James comes into his own. He's been a stealthy clinical pharmacologist for a long time, and you probably never heard him mention that because he isn't going about it at all. But we focus on the bug episodes, but I think I'm looking forward to hearing a bit of James' wisdom about really getting into nitty-gritty of pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics and how that is so important, because when we make decisions about choosing an antimicrobial, which we did a brief introduction to before, I think actually the more you think about it, obviously, like most things, the more complicated it gets. So James is going to walk us through a couple of things. Firstly, the factors affecting the distribution of an antibiotic or any drug really throughout the body. So that's vascular factors and drug factors. And then briefly talk about body fluid compartments and compartment models. So how do we look at the different parts of the sort of fluid within your body and how drugs get to them? Then touch on something called the volume of distribution, which you may or may not have heard about, and what factors affect those. Then you'll talk about penetrance of the drugs into different body cavities, and then we'll be done. So, James, I'm very much listening, most engaged here, so I'm a loyal listener in this episode, but I will pop in with some questions when you go off on things that I don't understand.
Yeah, fine, no problem. But I will try and keep this simple. So when you're thinking about, you know, pharmacokinetics, you've got absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion. Absorption and distribution are how does it get in and where does it go after it's in. And metabolism and excretion are what does the body do to get rid of it and where does it exit. So the distribution bit is really important to us as ID physicians because we want to know where the antibiotic is going to go to because we want it to get to the target site where the bug is to kill the bug. Yeah. So what affects distribution? Well, you've got blood vessel factors or vascular factors, and you've got drug factors. So let's start with vascular. So drugs will diffuse from the plasma, from the capillary beds into the interstitial space, and then to the intracellular space. And the more vascular an organ or a tissue is, like heart or lung or kidney, the more drug will be delivered to them compared to others, like, say, you know, fat or skin or bone. And one factor in particular which is important is how leaky the capillaries are, because if you've got something that's, you know, philic, say, and we'll come on to what that means in a second, it'll be difficult for it to leave the capillaries and get into the interstitial and then in intracellular space. There's like a lipid barrier, you know, at each of those junctures. But there are some ways to get drugs out. So some capillary bed epithelial cells have these 60 to 80 nanometer diameter pores, which allow drugs to leave and get into the interstitial space, particularly in the intestine and the pancreas and other places that you might not expect, like the kidney. And in other places, endothelial cells are separated by not tight junctions, which you might have heard of, but by slit junctions, and these are gaps which allow large molecules to move into the interstitium, and you can find those in the liver and bone marrow and lymph nodes and spleen, and these leak points will facilitate access of the drugs to the interstitial fluid.
And that kind of makes sense when you consider that obviously your body isn't designed, you know, us using medication is a relatively recent invention. And so this anatomical features exist for nutrients, for, you know, immune cells. So for other things to move in and out of the capillary.
Yeah. And the drugs take advantage of that. Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's the drug factors themselves. So, you know, are how good are they at crossing a phospholipid bilayer? You know, so every cell is basically a phospholipid bilayer with some stuff in the middle. And if you want to get to the intracellular space, like macrolides are really good at doing this, then you need to be able to cross that. In order to do that, you really have to be quite lipophilic and not particularly polar. And that will allow you to distribute into the cells, but also distribute into fat, you know, for example. And how exactly do you interact with proteins? In particular, do you bind plasma proteins very well? And so at this point, I think we have to talk about lipophilic versus lipophobic, or hydrophobic versus hydrophilic, depending on what your, you know, particular fancy is, Callum. You
can, yeah, the way I think about it is you've got lipophilic or hydrophilic.
Well, you're very positive, so you like philic things. I like phobic things, so I'm fine. I will stick to lipophilic, hydrophilic for you, Callum. But what does that mean? So lipophilic molecules will be find it very easy to diffuse out of plasma into surrounding tissues, and they will favour distribution to lipid-rich tissues. So if the drug has a net sort of negative charge, you know, you might call that a hydrophilic molecule. It might still be able to leave the capillary through these fenestrations that we've talked about before, but further penetrance into tissue will depend on the pH of the interstitial fluid, the drug PK, see our previous episode for that, and whether or not there are any solute carrier proteins that can be co-opted. Those are your OAT and OCT carriers that we mentioned before in the tissue that you're talking about.
Just a brief, what makes a drug lipophilic or hydrophilic?
Whether or not it's polarly charged. So if you're, because H2O, the O bit has a slight negative charge and the H bit has a slight positive charge, if you're slightly polar yourself, then you'll be able to kind of form a weak bond with one or the other sides of those water molecules. And so that means that you will be more likely to remain in that solution. And if you don't have any charge whatsoever, then you will find it much easier to pass through a phospholipid bilayer, because the phospholipid bilayer's whole thing is that it's trying to keep molecules out of the cell. Yeah. And then let's talk about plasma protein binding. So there's lots of plasma proteins that bind drugs. And reminder, plasma proteins are things that the liver produces that go into the bloodstream. But the main one, and the one that everybody knows about, is albumin. And each albumin molecule contains a bunch of different binding sites, and they bind with weak electrical polar bonds, so non-covalent bonds. And so that allows a bound drug to be stored, in inverted commas, and transported with the albumin, but also for it to be quickly released to become what's called free drug. And free drug is the bit that's not bound to albumin. And importantly, that's the bit that has its pharmacological effect. So not many drugs, I don't even know of any, Callum, actually have a pharmacological effect whilst they're still bound to albumin. And this is why, to give an example of sort of interactions related to albumin, it's important never to add aspirin to warfarin, but it's okay to add warfarin to aspirin. Because warfarin is, you know, bound to albumin, but it can be displaced by the aspirin. So if you get this, you know, massive increase in the amount of free warfarin because it's all been displaced and becomes free because aspirin is binding to the albumin, then you can get this massive increase in the INR. And I think that's how a bunch of other drugs also interact with warfarin to increase the INR. So yeah, so albumin is really important for transport of drug, but it also releases it fairly quickly. And the proportion of bound to unbound drug will remain the same regardless of concentration. So to give you an example here, Callum, aspirin is 50% protein bound. And that means that half of it will always be bound, of the total concentration will be bound to plasma at any one time. So if you've got a 1 millimolar plasma concentration, 0.5 will be protein bound. But if you only have a 0.1 millimolar plasma concentration, only 0.05 millimolars will be protein bound. Do you get what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's always a proportion of the total.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the last thing that we should mention is sort of binding to tissues and tissue binding sites. And so binding to tissue, like, say, to muscle, will drain, in inverted commas, the drug from the plasma and will reduce the amount of plasma-free drug. And in the show notes out here, I've got an example of, it's not an antibiotic, but digoxin. It's got a high affinity for sodium potassium ATPase, and skeletal muscle has lots of that, and so it tends to sort of soak up digoxin from the plasma, and this will lead to the drug having a higher volume of distribution.
Are there any antibiotics that have tissue binding?
Yes, there are. So in particular, there's lots of tissue binding with the macrolides. So they're coming up again and again as something that, because their plasma levels are very unimpressive, Callum, but
yeah,
they're having their effect in tissues, and in particular in the intracellular space. And so they sort of have an outsized effect based on what you would think you would get based on their VD.
Mm.
But now I think, Callum, we need to talk a little bit about compartments.
Callum. So I'm sure everyone remembers from medical school or undergraduate degrees, if you did physiology or, you know, whatever degree, this probably came. And if it didn't, then maybe we'll just explain it very briefly from basics. But I guess you can divide your body up into a series of compartments, which theoretical issue, but most studies look at 70 kilogram males. So we look at that and we say, okay, there's a solid mass. So in that 70 kilogram person, about 40% of that person will have solid mass. And then 60% will be their total body water. And then you can further divide that up into the intracellular fluid or the extracellular fluid. Now, the intracellular fluid is the fluid inside the cells, and that's 40% of your total body water. The total body water is about 42 litres, and the intracellular fluid is about 28 litres of that. The extracellular fluid is about 20% of the total body mass, so about a third of your total body water. And within the extracellular fluid, you've got interstitial and plasma.
Yeah, and interstitial is about 15% of total, and plasma is about 5% of total. And so here it's about 3.5 litres. You know, other people give different proportions totally. So the plasma, some say 3.5, some say 4, some say 5 litres, something like that. But yeah, if you're using a 70 kilogram male as an example, then about 3.5 will be plasma. So those are the kind of, you know, proportions that we're talking about.
Sidebar there, but one of the issues in pharmacology and studies is that generally speaking, it's unhealthy young volunteers, and a lot of those are, I guess, falling into the 70 kilogram male. So it means that we then have difficulty sometimes extrapolating that data to women or to the elderly.
Yeah, or to 100 kilogram podcast hosts as well. So I'm fully aware, Callum, that this is not generalizable. You sitting there as a 70 kilogram male telling me is the height of rudeness, actually, if you don't mind me saying. But anyway, you know, when we talk about where the drug distributes to, usually we will use a model, because it's, you know, impossible to determine the different concentrations in real life. And actually, a lot of the time we will use a one compartment model, which just assumes that the total body water, the 60% that we were talking about, is one big vat, and the drug just drops into that and then instantly distributes to throughout that 60 litres. And this is very, very simplistic, Callum, but I was told in medical school, but have not been able to verify, that that accounts for something like 2/3 of all drugs can be explained by the one compartment model. And something like up to 95% can be explained by a one or a two compartment model. And again, I've not been able to verify that statistic since researching this, but that was what I was taught in medical school as well. And the two compartment model is that there is the central compartment, which is the plasma, and the peripheral compartment, which is everything else, the intracellular fluid and interstitial fluid as well. And in order for the drug to distribute, it distributes from the plasma to the peripheral compartment. And then in order for it to be eliminated, it has to move from the peripheral compartment back to the central compartment, where it's then metabolized and excreted. And, you know, above the two compartment model, it gets too complex for a simple, naive clinical pharmacologist like myself. But there are multi-compartment models that extend way beyond this. Again, in medical school, I was told about a 17-compartment model that had been created for a drug. But this, I think, falls way beyond the scope of an ID physician. I don't think that you need to know about that, except that sometimes you have to think about the drug moving from the central compartment, the plasma, into the peripheral compartment, which is the tissues.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the volume of distribution. So this is a occasionally difficult to understand concept, but it is the thing that we use to comment on the distribution of a drug. And how it's defined is, it's the volume in litres that contain the total body content of the drug at a concentration equal to that present in plasma. I hope that's clear, Callum.
Well, just to rephrase that, just so I make sure I'm getting this right, because I've used this quite a lot and I think about it, but I always find it a bit difficult to wrap my head around what it actually means. Mm. So we know what the concentration of plasma is, and the volume in litres that contain the total body content of drug at the concentration equal. So essentially, if you have a high volume of distribution, then that would represent a drug that easily has moved from the plasma into the sort of peripheral compartments, so the interstitial fluid and intracellular fluid.
Yes, it
has. And if you had a low volume of distribution, that would represent a drug that is staying in the plasma well. So maybe something that's highly protein bound,
yeah,
and is hydrophilic.
Yes. So let's give a couple of examples and then people will know what we mean. Say that, to keep the number simple, let's say that the plasma is 5 litres. And let's say that I gave you a gram of a drug. And then, you know,
which drug?
It doesn't matter, any old drug. And then
give me amoxicillin.
I can't, because I'm about to use that as the second example.
Give me fluconazole.
I can't, because I don't have those precise numbers. Callum, can you just let me finish this?
Sorry.
All right. I gave you a gram of shut up and let me talk acillin. All right. And, and so I give you a gram of that, right? And then I measure the plasma concentration just, you know, 5 or 10 minutes after I've given it, and it's disseminated throughout the plasma. And I get a plasma concentration of 200 milligrams per litre. And I know you've only got 5 litres in you, right? And so I'll then say to myself, okay, well, I've given him a gram and I've got 200 milligrams per litre as the concentration. So if I divide that gram by the 200 milligrams per litre concentration, I get 5. So the volume of distribution is 5 litres. And sometimes people do this thing where they divide it by 70 to give you a VD sort of proportion, but it's that 70, where does that 70 come from, Callum? It comes from the 70 kilogram male of yesteryear. So I just think that kind of makes it a bit fuzzy and sort of, you're just arbitrarily dividing it by 70 for no particular reason. So there is a liters per kilogram notation that people sometimes use, and you can see it if you go and look for this on like DrugMag or something like that. If you get that and you want to convert it into liters outright, just multiply the number by 17 and you'll get the right number.
Okay.
So let's take a second example here, Callum, where I give you amoxicillin at a dose of 1,000 milligrams, and then 10 minutes later I give you the plasma concentration and it's 50. Well, what's the volume distribution there? So I gave you 1,000 milligrams, and then the concentration is 50, so I divide 1,000 by 50 and I'll get 20. So I'll have a volume of distribution of 20 litres, and that's a real example. So that is still an example of a fairly protein-bound, fairly low volume of distribution drug. But the, you know, these VDs can go up to hundreds of litres if they have something that leaves the plasma almost entirely. So we've got, you know, hydrophilic antibiotics like, say, beta-lactams, aminoglycosides, and glycopeptides. They will have a small VD and be consequently predominantly renally cleared with the low intracellular penetrance. Contrast that, if you like, with the lipophilic antibiotics that will probably have a large volume of distribution. They will see no reason to stay in the plasma, and so they will go out, and they will have a good intracellular penetrance. That would be an example, say, like the macrolides, fluoroquinolones, and linezolid as well. There are some things that you have to think about with the VD. Think factors that affect it would include protein binding and competition for binding sites, if binding sites are taken up by other drugs that would increase the amount of free drug that you're talking about. Because remember, it's only the free drug that will be able to distribute from the central compartment to the peripheral compartment.
So the constant. So to calculate a volume of distribution, it's the total amount of drug in body at time zero over the plasma concentration of drug at time zero.
Yes.
And time zero, you're saying, is 10 minutes after administration.
Because usually most of the VD calculations have been done with IV drugs. So if it was oral, right, you would have to give it a bit more time. So you would have to... Usually, actually, most of oral absorption is done by 20 or 30 minutes in, which is another good reason for, you know, having an oral's first approach to treating anything other than severe sepsis. So you see a lot of people using IVs because they want to get it in fast. Well, I mean, if you're doing that, fine, but you better make sure that the difference between 10 minutes and 30 minutes, you know, so that's a 20-minute time gap. You better make sure that that's the difference between life and death, because other than that, you're doing nothing for the patient by giving an IV, using...
Do you think that holds true because all our PK studies are done in healthy volunteers? Like, if someone is actually sick, does that affect your gut absorption at all?
Well, I mean, you have to make sure that the patient's got a functioning gut. And so if you aren't sure of that, then yeah, by all means, use IV. And you know, well, let me give you an example. This is sort of going back a little bit to the previous episode. But I have just been on general medicine take, as you know, for the month of January 2024. And I was coming across quite a lot of people who were not in septic shock, who didn't really have that much in the way of, you know, hypotension or even tachycardia on occasion, but were given IVs anyway, just to be sure. And I think there's some pretty convincing evidence these days that if you are not treating septic shock and the patient has a working gut, orals are just as good as IV, and that data is coming from a ton of trials and a ton of different situations.
So that's the factors that affect the volume of distribution, or the VD, as you termed it earlier. What about penetrance?
So the penetrance kind of depends on all of those factors that I discussed in amalgamation. And, you know, before I go on, the one and two compartment models will treat all the different tissue compartments as being comparable, but that is, you know, not true. And we, you know, we'll have to cover this separately because it's just too big to do now. But, you know, penetrance to, say, the brain, that's controlled by how good you are at crossing the blood-brain barrier, and some antibiotics are good at it and some aren't. Some are good at crossing an inflamed meninges and some are not, etc., etc. The heart, usually you're concerned about that because you're treating endovascular infection, so you'll want something that's kind of highly plasma bound. But, you know, dissemination to the skin is not necessarily a given. Penetrance to the lung, penetrance to the prostate. We're not mentioning any of this sort of stuff, but it is a feature of kind of when you're treating the infections, and particularly when you're choosing an antibiotic to, say, go into a microguide or a antimicrobial advice, you'll be taking all those things into account, whether or not you know it, because the studies that prove this drug works whereas that one doesn't will have factored that into their selection of that drug historically. But yeah, what I did then Callum is, I've got a table in the show notes here, and there's two, and what I went through all of the antibiotics, all the ones that we mentioned in the previous episode, and a few that we didn't, that are IV, because obviously I was focusing on highly bioavailable antibiotics at that time. And I've noted down their molecular weight in Daltons, their protein binding in percentage, and their volume of distribution. And the resources that I used for that were either drugbank.ca or the medicines.org.uk, the e-medicines compendium, where all the drug companies put their regulatory documents on their SPC, and their patient information leaflets are all available there. So then, I'm not sure I want to really go through this. I might just pull out a few interesting, you know, interesting bits. Callum, why don't you talk about flucloxacillin's protein binding?
Well, actually, there was something else I want to talk about, but I guess we should start narrow and then broaden out.
All right, go ahead.
So flucloxacillin, so that in the UK is our first-line treatment for Staphylococcus aureus bacteremia and lots of other severe infections.
Yeah, American listeners, nafcillin or dicloxacillin, depending on your flavour.
So flucloxacillin, so it's a sort of moderate size molecule, I guess, at 553 Daltons.
453.
Oh yeah, I can't read. Yeah. Wow. Screwed this up. At 453 Daltons.
You're going to leave this in, or are you going to re-record?
Yeah, I'll leave it in. Who cares?
All right, fine.
And it's hydrophilic. And the interesting thing, and this is, I always come back to this when I've got someone and it's not going right, which is that it's 95% protein bound. And so it's going to stick in the plasma, and its volume of distribution is 13 liters, which is relatively low.
No, very low, very low. Yeah, yeah.
And so it does make you think, is it getting into tissues? So no, we use it at very high doses when we're using it intravenously, like so 2 grams 6 hours late, so 8 grams total daily dose.
Yep, yep.
But when you're giving an oral flucloxacillin and you're maybe using 500 milligrams every 6 hours, that I think that's more where this starts to come into play. You know, it's highly protein bound. It's getting, spoilers for the next episode, it'll be getting metabolized and eliminated. So not that much of that drug is actually going to be getting into your tissues. Mm. And so then it's hardly surprising that someone with a skin soft tissue infection, and you give them that relatively low dose of flucloxacillin compared to what we can give IV, doesn't respond adequately. But then when you give them a drug that gets into tissue better, so let's maybe look at doxycycline as a quick comparator.
Mm.
So doxycycline is around about the same size, but the difference is there is that it's lipophilic. And although its protein binding is still quite high, so quoted at 80 to 93% compared to 95% for flucloxacillin, its volume of distribution is 52. So it's much higher. And that's coming down to mainly it being lipophilic. So I guess it is quite complicated. There's like a lot of different factors to weigh up when you're making this antibiotic selection. And I don't think it's as easy as saying, you know, lipophilic good, hydrophilic bad, or, you know, low volume of distribution good, high volume of distribution bad.
Well, no, not at all. Not at all, yeah.
But I think there is some niche points where knowing this sort of level of detail of antibiotics can be helpful. So one thing that I wanted to bring up, and James has spoken a lot, so I can keep talking and I'll let him in. Meropenem versus ertapenem.
Okay.
So there's two carbapenems. They have relatively similar spectrum, meropenem mainly having the addition of pseudomonal cover and also probably a bit more robust against some of our sort of carbapenemase, beta-lactamase type things. They're both hydrophilic, so they've got charge, but the protein binding, so meropenem, I think nobody would argue that meropenem is a great antibiotic if you want to kill all the bacteria, including the friendly ones. But it's only 2% protein bound. So it's right into the tissues. And that's reflected, it doesn't have a super high volume of distribution. So it's 17 to 24, which is maybe surprisingly low. But when you look at it for different body spaces, so does it get into CNS? It gets into the CNS very well. Does it get into the prostate? Yes, it gets into the prostate. It gets into lots of different body compartments very easily. And sometimes I think you can easily say like, oh, meropenem to ertapenem makes sense. But ertapenem, in contrast, is very highly protein-bound, greater than 85%, and its volume distribution is lower at 8.4. It doesn't seem like that big a difference. But then, you know, say you've got someone and they've got like a carbapenemase producing interbatch rallies and it's in a joint and you've got a septic arthritis. That actually might mean the difference between clinical response and not clinical response. I think it's slightly difficult because we're getting into a level of nuance which isn't really ever going to come out in a clinical trial. Like, I don't think you could, you know, you might be able to say meropenem versus ertapenem for this clinical condition, but whether you could ever turn around and say, like, you know, this protein binding affected that.
Oh, well, no, but Callum, there is that signal that the in people with low albumin state, in intensive care with a low albumin, that there tends, or there's a signal for higher failure rates with ertapenem. And, you know, people, you might be thinking, you know, why would that happen? Well, remember, it's the free bit of the drug that has its effect, but it's also the free bit that gets pissed out. And what people are thinking is that you just aren't getting highly maintained plasma levels with ertapenem if you've got a low albumin, because there's just not enough albumin to bind to, and so the free ertapenem gets renally excreted. So, yeah, I mean, again, not proven in an RCT, but, you know, it's an interesting signal, isn't it? And so with meropenem, you don't have to worry about that. I suppose the other one that I should mention is ceftriaxone. So it's also got a, you know, about 90% protein binding, a low volume of distribution, as really all of the beta-lactams do. That actually is what allows it to be dosed once a day, because again, it's only the free bit that gets excreted, and so that sort of almost contributes to its long half-life there, the high levels of protein binding that you get. So yeah, so loyal listeners can go and have a look at that table. We'll have a link to it in the show notes, and you all know where the prep notes for the episode are anyway. They're at the sort of footer at the end of the podcast description.
Someone should make a Top Trump style card game for this.
Oh, well, I mean, Empiric should be right on this.
Well, Empiric, we've played. Shout out to Empiric, which is a excellent card game for learning infections and antibiotics. Mm. We need to cover that in more detail at some point.
But, to be continued. But then the second table, Calm, is perhaps more interesting because, of course, all the beta lactams are hydrophilic. But that's not true of all the other.
The beta lactams are all relatively similar sizes, although the protein binding and volume distribution is
very. I mean, that does vary a lot, yes. But I mean, they are all basically, you know, between 300 and 600 Daltons. Not so table two, which opens with vancomycin at 1400 Daltons and dalbavancin at 1800 Daltons.
Yeah, that's big.
Yeah, that's massive. And if you've ever seen, I mean, I had a talk where I sort of had penicillin's molecular structure up against vancomycin's molecular structure, and it's just, you know, it's just several times bigger. It's huge, and it looks like a honeycomb almost. There's so many bits to it. But yeah, vancomycin, it's big, it's hydrophilic. That means it's going to have real difficulty moving out of plasma, and so its VD is quite low. It's between 28 and 70 litres. Still a little bit of it leaves the plasma. You know, it's not entirely in there. And a very middling protein binding, about 55%. Compare that, if you like, with its long-acting cousin, dalbavancin, which is almost 96% protein bound. And so that's why, and has a lower VD of about 14 litres, and that's why it is cleared much more slowly from the plasma. And so it's got this long half-life that means that you can give it, you know, once a week, yeah, if that. Yeah, so that's the difference between the long-acting glycopeptides and the short-acting ones.
I've been trying to read the volume of distribution to see which is the highest, and I thought I had a winner at tigecycline, which was 490 to 630, which is very high. And kind of makes sense because we know that tigecycline's, you know, licensed for intra-abdominal infection, and, you know, it's, I think, a fairly useful antibiotic when you're a bit stuck, but maybe it's not so good for bacteremia because it doesn't stay in the plasma that well.
Well, or has that dogma been driven by the large volume of distribution? But anyway, to be continued, Callum. But
yeah, tragedy of tigecycline.
But yes, that's not the winner, is it?
Azithromycin. What's going on? volume of distribution 2,177. What is that even? What is that?
We should talk about this. So that is the difference as you go up the macrolides from erythro to clarithro to azithromycin, is that you get much more lipid solubility and therefore volume of distribution goes up like several fold. And so the Clary's VD is between 190 and 300. So that's quite a lot, isn't it? But azithromycin just leaves the plasma instantly and just goes to the tissues. So its VD is 2,177 litres, as you said. And that, you know, you if you saw that, you'd think, oh, well, it's useless, you know, as an antibiotic. And it is for bacteremia, where the problem is within the bloodstream and it doesn't really stay in the bloodstream. But if your problem is in the tissues, or in particular, if it's in the cells, like, say, a mycoplasma pneumonia, which a bunch of people might be encountering based on my time in Gen Med, there seems to be a bit of a surge in mycoplasma going on at the moment.
Yeah, I've seen that as well.
Or other intracellular pathogens, like, say, Legionella, Chlamydophila, things like that, then you might prefer something like clarithromycin or azithromycin, because you know it's got this enhanced intracellular effect, which partly explains why, although they're not really all that bioavailable, they have this outsized effect, which means that orally they're basically just as good as they are. Quite big molecules too, 747 and 748 Daltons, respectively.
So maybe we've gotten to the end of the table, and I could look at this table for a while because I find it very easy to read. So thanks for putting that together. Mm. And also pretty comprehensive. There's probably antibiotics that you want to know that you've missed. So if you want us to add lines to the table, I mean, Jane, not me, then you could email us with some sort of suggestion, and we'd be happy to add them.
Thanks, Callum. Thanks for this. But yeah, so people can look in their own time, and you know, all this information is publicly available. Is there anything else that sort of stands out to you? I mean, I guess the quinolones also have quite high VD, you know, between 90 and sort of 200, depending on which one you're looking at.
What else stands out? Metronidazole is quite interesting. It's quite small, 171. It's lipophilic. Mm. It's less than 20% protein bound. It doesn't have a massive volume of distribution at 36 to 77. That's quite interesting. It kind of explains it gets into abscesses, it gets into empyemas pretty well.
Yeah.
What's the lowest volume of distribution?
The lowest, that's probably
daptomycin.
Yeah, and highly protein-bound as well, and big, 1,600 Daltons. But yeah, I suppose that does all that sort of might make it good for sort of plasma stuff.
Well, it's kind of like you've got your initial batch remix in a severe illness, and you need to have drugs that are going to stick in the plasma to get rid of that. But then it sort of comes down to what your primary source is. You know, you're not batch remix as an initial thing. It's usually a bacteremia secondary to X. So then it comes down to where is the site of infection, and that should change it. So rather than saying we're going to treat Staph aureus bacteremia, we say we're going to treat Staph aureus bacteremia with the primary source being X.
Yeah, like pneumonia or urine or an endovascular device, you know, all that sort of thing. Yeah.
That's sort of come out, but you know, I guess sometimes we say bacteremia equals list management, and instead we should say infection focus with bacteremia. And maybe it does affect your ferro. Shouldn't be the same treatment for all bacteremias.
Yeah, and I suppose we do kind of do that a wee bit with, like, to take daptomycin as an example. Daptomycin is, it's a big molecule. It gets trapped by surfactant. It's not inactivated, it gets trapped by surfactant, Callum. And that means that it can't then go on and sort of bind its target site. And so that's why it doesn't work for lung infections. So people like know bits and pieces like that, but they don't have like a comprehensive overview of all these little sort of bits and pieces about distribution. And neither do I, by the way. I'm not saying that I do and nobody else does, but like, you know, people might know a fact about this drug and a fact about that drug, and it might be related to the distribution, but they, you know, don't have an idea about the sort of gestalt of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think to summarise my thoughts on this is that I feel like this is something that I've come back to over the years in patients where you're in a tricky situation, you're kind of going maybe a bit off-piste because the usual primary options aren't available, or the protection's got complicated, or you're not succeeding. And it's useful to think about these things. And I guess the things that James has taken us through there was, you know, what the vascular factors and the drug factors relating to distribution, whether something's lipophilic or hydrophilic, how plasma protein bound it is, and then its volume of distribution throughout the different tissues and what affects that. And finally, its penetrance into different body compartments, which we haven't gone into depth about. We will in the future. And then finally, summarizing that all with the molecular weight, the lipophilicity, the protein binding, and the volume of distribution. And together, that gives you quite a bit of information. It's not the full picture. We're going to come back to it. And you should go blathering about bioavailability. And thank you, Jane, for talking me through that, because I feel like I understand it a bit better now.
Ah, that's a lovely compliment to end on. Thanks, Gal.
Thank you for listening to the Idiots Podcast, the UK's premier infectious disease podcast. We are supported by the British Infection Association, but they do not have creative control over the episode content, so please don't blame them if we get something wrong.
Questions, comments, suggestions? Why don't you send them in to idiotspodcasting@gmail.com. Have a 5-star review in your pocket? Calm and I would love to have it. Please drop it in your podcast player of choice. We tweet at @idiots_pod. And if you want to donate to support the show, there's a link to do so in the description. But until next time, I'm Jane.
I'm Callum.
See you then.
Now that the episode's done, we hope you learned and had lots of fun. So go forth and treat people with some of what you now know.